talk about a couple of influences as to the reasons why this happened to be emerging, one of which is the film The Quiet Man, which stars John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara. John Wayne is a boxer who is from Ireland, goes back to Ireland, and the Technicolor, which was a big deal to announce mm-hmm. that it was a Technicolor film back in 1952 when the film was released. People got to see the colors of Ireland in the countryside. At the same time, there was this fascination with Irish-connected celebrities. Mm-hmm. Grace Kelly, whose father was an Olympic champion from Philadelphia, but of Irish-American heritage. And then, of course, we have in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, John F. Kennedy becoming prominent in politics and his wife really showcasing fashion. So you combine the two of these and you mention that some of the roots are there.
There's a lot to unpick there. So I might start with The Quiet Man, which to this day remains a very, very well-known depiction of Ireland from America, which then gets adapted pretty much by tourism interests in Ireland, you know, to sell. So you have this strange journey. So yeah, Technicolor was huge because this Technicolored landscape of The Quiet Man, this 1952 movie, was really, really influential. It disseminated this image of a color-saturated rural Irish landscape to potential American tourists to Ireland. And I should note as well that the men's costumes in the movie very deliberately showcased hand-woven Irish tweed. And to this day, the store in Galway that sold the movie, the tweeds, advertises that fact, you know, half a century later. It's not a coincidence then that, you know, 1952 is when Irish fashions start to sell in America, start to be exported in huge numbers. 1952 is this movie. And then it's not a coincidence that the Irish textile industry of that very period then began experimenting with more vibrant colours for wools and lace. So wools and lace used to be white and grey, and very, very occasionally you get red wool. And all of a sudden, they become technicolor. What's interesting about this is that it begins to be sold as reflective of the Irish landscape, when in fact, this experimentation with bright dyes really speaks to technological advance and indeed sensitivity to market demands. So again, an absolute modernity is being sold as tradition.
And as you also mentioned, some of the deep history from the famine, the potato famine, as most people know about it, the economic effects in Ireland were still reverberating during the 20th century. And now that we're in the post-World War II era, the government of Ireland is looking for ways to improve the economy, which was still trying to recover after the war, of course.
I think fashion is one of the spheres in which the you can actually trace it back quite directly to the famine. So, you know, as I said, in the 1950s, there was a very successful Irish fashion export, and it was marketed as a continuation of very, very vaguely defined what were called old traditions. And I think they had to be vague because the true heritage of Irish needlecrafts and textiles would not have been palatable because these craft industries, you know, upon which really this mid-century fashion export industry relied, these were rooted in the trauma of the famine. Clothing promoted explicitly as Irish in this mid-century period, they often combined hand-woven textiles with very fashionable cuts. And despite the fact that they're always fashionably cut, the marketing only really emphasised what was called the tradition. So it was a sort of a sleight of hand in many ways, and it deflected from the fact that any heritage aspect of Irish fashion garments generally inhered in these textiles and their famine-era fair trade origins, really, rather than their design. There was effectively no traditional Irish clothing in the 50s. There was only traditional Irish fabrics.
You mentioned the sleight of hand that you use in your paper, that these were articles of clothing made by poor people that became known as luxury items when
right.
they were marketed.
It's an odd industry in many ways, in that the primary designers are indeed Irish women. And they're often elite Irish women, or Irish women who certainly have elite connections. Sybil Connolly, whom I may talk about, was very good friends with Jackie Kennedy, for instance. That said, you know, male-centred and male-authored Irish economic histories often underemphasise the degree to which this apparel industry in the 1950s and women's paid piecework, you know, was in some ways, it's an interesting way to think about women's history. Yes, Connolly was herself an elite woman. She employed over 100 women to weave and crochet in the 1950s, and she earned $500,000 a year from her American exports. There were women working at home and in factories who made or finished these garments, these textiles and the lace ordered by Connolly and her rivals. And it's clear that the fashion boom benefited Irish women with very few economic avenues. So because there are all these seesaws between signifiers of tradition and modernity in the marketing of Irish fashion, but the reality was that Ireland was neither fully traditional in the way, you know, promised by the Quiet Man, in the way promised to tourism, nor was it evenly modernised either. Thus, I think the you know, this female-dominated workforce for Irish couture can be seen both as exploited and as harbingers of Irish women's growing autonomy. It must be stressed, though, that the low wages in a still developing Irish economy meant that the mid-1950s couture prices were low. So, for instance, an Irish couture dress in a New York department store would be $400. The Parisian equivalent was $2,000. And, of course, these women, the women who worked, who did the piecework for the likes of Connolly, could not afford these clothes themselves. They themselves wore ready-to-wear garments or locally tailored garments. There's an interesting echo here, you know, right back to the post famine period again, in which very exquisite, very expensive handmade Irish lace was worn only by the Irish and the British elite, because the women who made it, of course, lived in cottages, could not afford it themselves. And there's a lovely 1960 Irish government survey of the wool industry, and it concluded, I love this phrase, that, quote, peasant handwovens have become a luxury product right to this day.
You did a lot of work with the historical costume and textile collection. Laura Crow, who was a costume designer for many years for the Connecticut Repertory Theater. What was it like working with those folks who have this amazing collection and our virtual museum, so you can go online and look at all the gowns and costumes that exist?
Laura was incredibly generous with her time and with her holdings. She photographed a 1958 Irish wool suit for me, and it actually made it onto the cover of the journal issue. They have incredible holdings, and I was amazed at what they had when I went looking, that right here on my doorstep were the kinds of garments that I needed to photograph for my article.